Shenandoah Department of Social Services case. I don't have them designated. Is it Ms. James that, yes, Ms. James, we're ready when you are.
Thank you, Your Honor. Before I get started, I'd like to reserve maybe 3 minutes.
3 minutes.
Of my argument time.
Yes.
Thank you. May it please the court, as I stated, I'm Shelley James, and I represent Ms. Kogar in this termination of her parental rights in relation to two children. This case was appealed to the circuit court. Judge Ludwig issued a written opinion that delves into most of the facts, and the rest of the facts were presented to the court via a statement of facts. The basic issue in this case is whether or not the legal standard has been met for termination of parental rights. Under 16.1-283C, either one or the other of two conditions must be met by proof of clear and convincing evidence in order to terminate parental rights. Either the parent must fail to maintain contact with the children and there not be any good cause for that failure to contact, or the parent must fail to remedy the conditions without reasonable cause that led to the placement of the children into foster care. Judge Ludwig found that both of those conditions could apply here, and we respectfully argue that neither of those conditions were met, especially not by clear and convincing evidence. In this case, the children were removed from their mothers.
Counsel, this is Judge Alston.
Yes.
Did correctly the standard of review and the standard for the trial judge to make the determinations of whether termination was right or not. But the clear and convincing evidence standard, as you've previously articulated, is one in which the fact finder is entitled to consider the evidence and then make a determination whether in its view and exercising its discretion as a fact finder whether the evidence was clear and convincing. Where did the trial judge miss that mark?
Your Honor, the trial judge certainly was entitled to make the findings of fact, but when you apply that law to those facts, that's where the judge missed the mark here. In finding that my client failed to maintain contact with the children without a good cause for that failure, though the department claims that the contact was sporadic or tries to claim that she was late from 5 minutes to 1 hour for over half of the times. What they don't say is that she failed to maintain contact. What the court did not say was before June 22nd, 2016, that she failed to maintain contact. It is only after that point that she did not maintain contact. And the sole reason for that was because the department refused to allow her to have contact until there was this meeting that they decided would be required. She set up a meeting. She then had to cancel that meeting. The testimony was that she tried to contact the department. The testimony was also that the department received those contacts and did not respond to them. She might have only called twice, but the department, who admits they received those calls, did not return those calls, and in fact said that they would not because there was an ongoing investigation. And so my client could have done nothing to contact her children. The department had the children, and the department would not let her contact the children, which we would argue is good cause for her failure not to maintain contact with the children.
Didn't your client move to West Virginia?
She did, Your Honor, but she still maintained contact with the children after she moved to West Virginia. She came for trips. In fact, some of those the visits had to be canceled because the trip was so long and she had car issues or other things that were going on trying to find transportation. But she still continued to come and visit the children. Sometimes she was late, sometimes they had to be canceled, and sometimes they had to be canceled at the last minute, but she still continued to come and see the children.
Ms. James, this is Judge Attlee. Didn't she also ask that her visitation be halved to bi-monthly once she moved to West Virginia?
She did, Your Honor, but that still she still maintained contact with the children. There was no argument that, and there is no case law that says that bi-monthly contact is not is a failure to maintain contact with children. In fact, there are cases where the department only allows bi-monthly contact with children. You know, it's all in the department's hands. Here, because of the problems Mom had, she had to cut back on that contact, but she still maintained contact, and there's no indication in the record that she wasn't having good visits with the children, that there were any problems with these visits, that the children had become distant and cold from her and didn't seem to recognize her. There was nothing that suggested that the level of contact she was having was detrimental to the children or seemed to hurt their relationship. The problem on June 22nd was not about her behavior with the children. It was about something that was said outside the presence of the children, and there was never any testimony that it even had any impact on the children. So we would continue to maintain that she did maintain contact with the children, that even if she asked for by week, by month, still maintaining contact.
Counsel, that's, correct me if I'm wrong, in appendix at page 30, excuse me, it indicates that your client had not seen the children since June 2016, which at that point had been 6 months. Between that time and the time that the case was brought to hearing. Do you agree or disagree with that?
We agree, Your Honor. After June 22nd, the department would not allow her to have contact with her children. That was, she tried to contact the department to have this meeting that they insisted they wanted to have. The department would not return her calls. They testified that they would not return the calls. And so she was never able to have contact with the children again. We agree that if, you know, she had just not shown up for appointments for 6 months, then that would certainly be her fault. And she unless she was in the hospital or something, there might not be an excuse for that. Here,
let's assume, Counsel, that we're able to get over the first hurdle that you've mentioned. And, again, you've laid out the proper standard. How do you deal with the fact that apparently that the trial court or the fact finder found that within 12 months of the children's placement in foster care that your client had not made the appropriate efforts to remedy substantially the conditions leading to the foster care placement?
Your Honor, this case is a little unusual in that what led to the children being removed is that their mother took them to the hospital.
She said that there was a GPS that was inserted into their bodies.
Yes, she certainly had some delusions, whether those were based on things that the father of the children had said that she believed or not, I don't know. She says that these are things that the father told her. Be that as it may, she didn't attempt to take these things out of her children herself. She took the children to the hospital to see what the hospital would find. This in no way endangered the children. And actually, in the appendix on page 25, as part of Judge Ludwig's opinion letter, the third paragraph down talks about Dr. Showalter's diagnoses. And the department, in its brief, talks about how the reason for removal was because my client was supposedly in such a bad psychological state that there was concern that the children would be harmed. But that's not the reason that was stated for the children being removed. It was specifically for her going to the hospital. There is nothing about the department having any of these diagnoses before Dr. Showalter's report. And the third paragraph on page 25 of the appendix, Judge Ludwig finds that Dr. Showalter's diagnostic impressions were post-traumatic stress disorder, provisional, unspecified bipolar disorder by history, and paranoid personality features. Despite the recitation of these fairly unspecific conditions and generally unhelpful to the layman, if one reads Showalter's report as a piece, other than bizarre contact likely resulting from paranoia, Covert does not appear to have been in the psychological shambles that the court frequently, perhaps generally, sees in termination cases. The court did not find that the reason that they had been, that the children had been removed from Ms. Koger was because she was having some kind of mental breakdown. There is no evidence of that in this record.
Yes, assuming we agree with that, counsel, didn't the court also said that your client had questionable living arrangements, having moved several times in West Virginia, living with somebody whose name she could not remember, that her employment was unstable, and that the DSS could not safely return the children to her because it would not be in the children's best interest. In other words, the court, I guess a short way of saying my question is the court did not necessarily make its determination on the mental deficiencies perceived or not, but rather because of the circumstances that your client presented in the time that was set aside to remedy the situation that brought the children into foster care in the first place.
And I agree with that, Your Honor. My client, I cannot argue that my client's situation did not degenerate after the children were taken from her. The facts certainly support that conclusion. But at the time that the children were removed from her, she had a job. She had a house. She lived here in Virginia. The statute 16.1-283 is very clear. It's not just to terminate parental rights. We're not talking about taking the children out of foster care. We're not talking about anything else. But to terminate parental rights, you can't just find that it's in the child's best interest. I think in part the reason for this is because it's a parental rights are constitutional rights. So what's in the child's best interest needs to be weighed. And in the statutory structure that's set up by the legislature, it has to be weighed in that the court has to find as a matter of law, based on clear and convincing evidence, that there's been a failure to maintain contact without good cause, or a failure to remedy the conditions that led to the placement in foster care. While perhaps it would be easier and maybe even better if the statute were worded differently, the statute does not say the conditions that continue to keep the children in foster care. The statute plainly says fail to remedy conditions that led to the placement.
And by statute, doesn't that essentially place the burden on your client to remedy the circumstances
that led to the children going into foster care? And that was remedied, though the department says that it is ridiculous to argue that it was remedied because she never had custody of the children again. She also never attempted to take the children to the hospital again. She never suggested that the children be taken to the hospital again. And Dr. Showalter, in talking to her, it is clear that she was no longer in the same condition that she was when she took them to the hospital, that she was saying these were things that the father said to her, that she was just trying to investigate things.
Ms. James? I just want to make sure that you're aware. You're in your three-minute rebuttal time, which is fine, but I just want to make you aware.
If your honors have no further questions, then I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Ms. James, this is Judge Atlee. Again, I do have a quick question for you because I want to make sure we're all on the same page as to what the statute says. And am I correct that C2 doesn't just speak to what led to the child ending foster care, but also speaks to the continuation, required continuation of the child's foster care placement? That is to say that without good cause has been unwilling or unable within a reasonable period of time, not to exceed 12 months from the date the child was placed in foster care, to remedy substantially the conditions which led to or required continuation of the child's foster care placement.
That is true, Your Honor. It does have the or in there. Our position is that first sentence, first part, to remedy substantially the conditions that led to, is what the judge found in this case, was that she had not remedied the conditions that led to the or required continuation of the child's foster care placement. We would argue in this case that while her situation had deteriorated, there is no evidence that where she was living was inappropriate. There is no, she clearly was able to support herself. She had family members who were continuing to assist her, and so there was, in addition, no reason to continue the children in foster care.
Well, Ms. James, looking at Joint Appendix page 31, the last sentence of the next to the last paragraph of judge's letter opinion, doesn't it state that rather it is her unwillingness to do the things that were not unreasonably required of her to prevent the continuation of the removal?
The judge does find that. You are correct, Your Honor.
Which would then satisfy the second part of the disjunctive clause that you made reference to.
Yes, though we would argue that there, again, that there is not evidence to support that in the record.
But I thought you admitted that her condition deteriorated.
Her condition certainly did deteriorate, Your Honor, but it does. There's, if that's the standard for whether or not children should continue to remain in foster care, then, quite honestly, very few children will ever come out of it.
But she continued to be homeless as of the date of trial, is that correct?
She was living in with the testimony was a little confusing. She had a home over in West Virginia, but she had recently come back to Virginia and was looking for employment here. And while she was doing that, she was living with a person in Augusta County.
That she didn't know the name of.
Is this the person whom she could not name?
That is correct.
Well, clearly that's not exactly a position that's suitable for the, a placement that's suitable for the children, is it?
Your Honor, I can't answer that question because I don't know. I don't know what the housing situation was like. I don't know who this person was.
Didn't know that either. They don't know the name of the person. They don't know the conditions of the household. They don't know the suitability of the household. They don't know the size of the household. Isn't that all part of the point when we're coming to the trial date, when this matter's been pending for quite a period of time?
That certainly is, Your Honor. The problem in this particular case is that it's not my client's burden to prove by clear and convincing evidence that she has substantially remedied the conditions that led to or required the continuation of the child's foster care placement. It is the department's burden. And the court here found that the department had met that burden when they basically didn't know the answers to any of those questions. And the judge didn't know the answer to any of those questions.
How can they know the answer to a question when they don't even know where she's living because she's bounced around quite a bit and very recently relocated to Virginia? Isn't that put the department in an impossible position?
In an abstract case, yes, Your Honor, it might. But in this case, there is no evidence. My client bounced between, I believe it was two different addresses. The department never attempted to go to West Virginia to review either of these addresses. Now, there was testimony that the West Virginia Department of Social Services attempted a home study, and I quite honestly can't remember. I think that they stopped that process because she was uncooperative, if I remember correctly.
Your time has more has more than expired. Perhaps we should hear from Mr. Glick now.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, may it please the court. My name is James Glick. I represent Shenandoah Valley Social Services, who is obviously the appellee herein. And in addressing just the last bit of discussion with Ms. James, there was, in fact, an interstate placement home study requested by the Department of Social Services on one of the two homes, three homes, actually, that the mother had identified in West Virginia, and it was denied due to lack of cooperation. And subsequent to that, while Ms. James has indicated that the department did not make contact with her, the testimony did not bear out that assertion. The statement of facts actually recites some of the context, specifically being certified letters that were sent to Ms. Kogar that she personally signed for as having received, asking her to get in touch with the Department of Social Services and provide them with contact information because her phone numbers were no longer operative. She did make two telephone calls to DSS, and DSS, the department, did in fact testify that they did not return those calls because they had, at that point, when those two calls occurred, had received new allegations of sexual abuse and had an active investigation, and the Child Protective Services, which is a separate section from the Foster Care Services section, had requested that there not be any contact for a very brief period of time with Ms. Kogar, and that brief period of time was a matter of 2 to 3 weeks. And
was
subsequent
this,
to that,
was this communicated?
I'm sorry.
Was this communicated to Ms. Kogar? In other words, you have a CPS investigation and you have a social service investigation. Obviously, they're going on two separate tracks. Did the DSS people communicate with Ms. Kogar that the reason why they weren't communicating with her was because of the CPS investigation?
They attempted to, Your Honor, both by telephone, and that's when they discovered that they had no longer had any operative telephone number for her or contact information. And then one of the three certified letters that was sent was from Child Protective Services regarding that investigation, but they received no response to any of those communications.
Well, wouldn't you agree, sir, that it presents a dilemma for Ms. Kogar if in one instance she's accused of not cooperating with the process or trying to remedy the conditions, but yet the Department of Social Services won't communicate with her to enable her to cooperate or do what she needs to do as far as maintaining contact with the children and the like? Doesn't that sort of take us in a circular route?
I think it could if that recitation was actually what happened. The problem was that, again, for a brief period of time, about 2 to 3 weeks, there was no return call from the Department of Social Services to her on her two telephone calls to DSS, and then for months thereafter, the department attempted repeatedly to make contact with her and had no response from her, and continued to have no response from her. And that ties in additionally to the question of visitation, where, you know, Ms. James is arguing, or the appellant is arguing, that the department wouldn't allow her to have contact with the children, and that is just simply not supported by the judge's opinion letter, specifically in the appendix on page 48, where he's talking about the last visit that did happen on June 22nd of 2016. And in the middle of the final paragraph of that page is a very clear sentence that there was some dispute as to what happened on June 22nd, but there was no question that the department left open the door to permit Kogar to reinitiate visitation. They invited her to not just one meeting that she canceled, but two meetings that she canceled, and she then proceeded to fall off the radar. And that led to the children, or to her having no contact with the department or the children for a period in excess of 6 months, actually from June 23rd. And the first real contact that she had with the Department of Social Services was then on the trial date of April 4th of 2017. You know, a period of 9.5 months, or 9 months, excuse my math, where she made no efforts whatsoever, and that was clearly found by the court, again, on page 49, discussing the same things of what she had done in terms of continuing contact with the children. and the last sentence of the second full paragraph of that page is just the plain fact is she has done nothing. And we are blessed often in Augusta County with Judge Ludwig's records and his opinion letters in that he takes a fairly detailed accounting of the testimony as it's presented, as well as laying out very clearly his reasoning and his argument and his application of the facts as he has found them to the statutes as they apply. And I say we're blessed by that. Occasionally we are drowned by that. But this court has the, and I apologize, but this court has the opportunity to really see into his mind in that he writes such a complete and full version of his analysis of the facts as he found them. And this court is bound to his findings of facts, unless they are shown to be plainly wrong. And I think that there's no indication of that. There's no indication that those facts that he found, that she did nothing, that she did not maintain contact, that contact was open to her, that she did not remedy the conditions which led to the continuation of the children's foster care stay, all of those things are supported by his recitation of the testimony as he heard it. I do think this is simply a case of hoping and praying, perhaps, that the court will overturn a decision that is unfortunate, but I don't believe there's any legal basis to do so. I had promised Mr. Schwartzel, as the guardian ad litem, that I would reserve at least a bit of time for him, and I know that you all have another case, so unless there are further questions, I would just encourage you to review Judge Ludwig's findings and his application of the facts as he found them to the law.
Thank you, Mr. Glick. There remains 8 minutes, and Mr. Schwartzel, you're welcome to them.
Thank you. May it please the court. In this case is unfortunate, but I must agree with the department's position and the finding of Judge Ludwig. It's clear in the evidence presented at the trial that Ms. Kogar, while she may have made a few attempts to maintain contact with her children, and as her counsel pointed out, made two attempts, she stopped. Made no further attempts. The department had the opportunity she could have, and that resulted in a 9-month period where she had no contact with her children. The department couldn't find her because she moved. I couldn't find her. I'm not sure appellant's counsel could find her except when she contacted. And even if she had maintained contact, the court found that there were clear instructions that she was given that were valid based on the circumstances, mainly to receive psychological counseling based on the interim diagnosis of Dr. Showalter, which the appellant did not comply with. She produced no evidence that she continued, and she followed the very basic and first instructions she had to make even the first minute steps toward remedying the situation to bring her children home. So in this case, it was in the best interest of the children to uphold the termination, and I would ask this court to